Let's find a conversation to your soul. Let's conversation to your soul and the
Prestige heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and I am extremely, genuinely excited to welcome to the podcast today my old friend Glenn Lowry. You know him, but just to repeat, Glenn is the Merton P. Stoltz Professor Emeritus of Social Sciences, Professor Emeritus of Economics, and Professor Emeritus of International and Public Affairs at Brown University, and he's also the host of the excellent The Glenn Show, which I have been listening to in some form or other since I think 2008. Glenn, I'll always remember after Obama was elected, you kept on saying Barack Hussein Obama, and John McWhorter, your co-host, was like, "Are you just going to keep on saying Hussein?" Because it was such a moment. I'll always remember that, exactly where I was when I listened to that podcast. It was in San Diego. But anyway, thank you for joining us, and we're here to talk about your recently re-released book, Self-Censorship, which was originally published in 1994, and we'll get into that there. But Glenn, first of all, it's an honor to have you on the podcast. Thank you so much.
Oh, Danny, thanks for the introduction. Good to be here. Hello, Derek.
Derek said hello.
He made me dive for the mute button, but it's very, very nice to have you. And congratulations on re-releasing the book.
So there's so much to talk about here, and I want to get into all of it because this is a book I think that was re-released in light of this, you know, contretemp, as it were, over quote unquote wokeness or what have you. But let's get in our time travel machine and let's travel back to the mid 1990s. It's 1994. And Glenn, what was going on in the culture? What was going on in the intellectual discourse that made you want to write a book on self-censorship?
Well, a couple of things. And I really began work on this essay that was published in 1994. I began work on it in the late 1980s. And I think a couple of things were going on. One of them, and you will know this better than I, was the ferment within intellectual circles in the Soviet-dominated world in Eastern Europe, the kind of beginnings of the rumblings of a kind of intellectual opposition to it in Hungary, in Poland, in Russia, and the idea that the state was encroaching upon civil discourse, and there was underground and there was Samizdat and all of that. The other thing for me was I was engaged in critical commentary about civil rights, race-related, social policy, inequality issues, domestic. And I was developing an argument that was more Booker T. Washington than W.E.B. Du Bois kind of spirited. And I was getting a lot of pushback on that and felt myself to be kind of a renegade, kind of a, you know, the kind of guy that people would call an Uncle Tom and stuff like that. And I wanted to theorize the dilemma of the individual in that situation and kind of attempt to analyze the social forces that create that kind of a situation. So I had motivations that were more particular to the debate amongst African-Americans and in American political culture about race and racial inequality. And I was a Reagan supporting conservative in the 1980s, and I moved away from that. But I don't know. Am I getting at what you're asking me about, Danny?
No, that's precisely right. I want to know the context, because it might be, I mean, it'll be interesting for listeners to understand, like, what were the stakes of the debate going on within the Black intellectual class? Why would you have been called an Uncle Tom? What was sort of the nature of your arguments? Because if you were called an Uncle Tom, then one would imagine you actually weren't self-censoring. So was the implication that other people were self-censoring? They weren't getting at hard truths about what was going on with Black America at the time? I think it might be worthwhile to sort of lay out the stakes of the debate, or the contours at least, about where this text emerged from.
Okay. So the civil rights movement is over. The problems in Black society are palpable. The narrative of exclusion, marginalization, and discrimination is shop-worn. The leadership within the Democratic Party, within the mainstream modes of cultural influence, is intellectually bankrupt. This is what I'm thinking. Any way that I tell this story will kind of be indicative of a ideological position, you know? I mean, it.
So it is. We are all ideological. I mean, actually, I'm a free-floating intellectual, but everyone besides me is ideological.
You know, can you imagine trying to be a Black conservative this period in the 1980s and the 1990s? I mean,
well, it's interesting because I think
your very existence is absurd. I mean, it's a kind of joke. I mean, it's a, you know, who could take it seriously? You know, and yet I was serious.
And so what did you think that people were self-censoring about with regards to that debate? My sense, and tell me if I'm wrong, is that there was a problem with quote-unquote Black culture and that people weren't addressing that sort of elephant in the room, and that you felt that this wouldn't basically lead to some sort of, I guess, progressive uplift? Or what was the goal to become like a neoliberal?
Yeah, there were a number of things. The culture thing was one of them, going back to Moynihan and whatnot. You know, what was permissible to be said about the Black family, about the behavioral dimension of social exclusion, because it involves responsibility. And it, as I say, any way you describe it commits you to a kind of political program. If you impute too much agency, if you are not sufficiently attentive to the weight of history, if you don't have a kind of victim, exploiter, dominator, dominated framework, if you talk about personal responsibility, if you have a spiritual dimension to what you're saying that exhorts people to live better, if you judge, if you say the violence is despicable, if you say welfare dependency is a narcotic, you're a handmaiden to a endorser of legitimizer and justifier of domination, exploitation, and so on. So, like I said, you know, being a Black conservative is kind of absurd at some level in many people's minds, and I heroically, you know, kind of gave voice to all of the horrible opinions that you've heard me just recapitulate.
But one thing before we get into the book, and we could talk about sort of what I really liked about it, is that it read like it seems like a type of social science that isn't really written any longer. It was like social theory, you know, it was like a Weberian social theory that we're going to like move through a problem and we're going to think about it rigorously, but we're not going to rely on quantitative metrics, which is, you know, my understanding, not exactly what's hot right now. And perhaps one of the reasons that the social sciences aren't doing as great as they might otherwise be. But before we get into that book, I'm just...
Can I comment on what you just said, Danny?
Yeah, go for it.
Because I really, really appreciate it. I mean, Weber, you know, but I mean, anyway, the aspiration to thinking in a way that will have some kind of force that at a high level of social, intellectual, theoretic reflection, you know, I'm reading Thomas Sowell's books now because I have this responsibility to contribute to overseeing a conference honoring his life's work at the Hoover Institution. And I see him, you know, communing with the greats. And, you know, I you know, you can think what you think about Thomas Sowell. I don't want to change the subject and talk about him. Just to say, I've been in the cast of mind of thinking about the greats. And there are greats. you know, of social science literature. I mean, I think Irving Goffman, the sociologist, is a great. I think Thomas Schelling, the economist. I think Albert Hirschman, the political economist, are great. These are people whose writings I draw on in this essay and who inspired me and whose style I sought to emulate. Because you're right, they're not I-dotting, T-crossing formalists who reduce all the richness of the problem to the few parameters that they can quantify and specify in their reductive formalistic models. They and there's you can breathe. There's more air in the room when you don't tie yourself down in that kind of a turgid kind of way.
Well, human social life just isn't amenable to it. I mean, fundamentally, as from an ontological level, it is an absurd project. Glenn, we've argued about this on your podcast before, but you just can't quantify human existence in that way. It's a fundamental thing, and we looked back on historically as a strange fetish that basically dominated the American Academy from 1950 to today and perhaps longer. And that's what I like about Weber. It's what I like about Marx. It's what I like about Hirschman. It's what I like about Schelling, even if I disagree particularly with Schelling's theory of human nature, essentially. It allows you to actually rigorously pursue a social problem.
You know, as I say, I was looking at Sowell's books and stuff, and he's out of the Chicago school, you know, of Milton Friedman and Friedrich von Hayek and stuff. And I was trained at MIT. Paul Samuelson's legacy and influence was very influential there. And this kind of argument within economics about formalism, about the mathematical, you know, limits of it, and what is economics really about? And the Samuelsonian tradition is very formalistic. It's very, you know, applying the insights from theoretical mathematical physics kind of framework to social issues. It has an engineering kind of feel to it. And I thought the Chicago school, albeit, yes, archly conservative and very much of a libertarian tinge and a market fetishizing, but it also had a sense of what the enterprise was about that was less confined, I think, than the calculus and the linear algebra kind of stuff. Anyway, that's just an aside.
Well, and you know what I think. These are all Jews trying to assimilate. So these are, I mean, if you want to talk about strategies, these are strategies of assimilation, right? If you basically abstract things from their environment, you're basically able to make universalistic arguments about humanity that don't rely on ethnic particularity.
Do you know the Cudahy book? The Ordeal of Civility?
I've heard you talk about it, but I've never. This is the 70s. It's early 70s. I looked into it after you mentioned it. Right? It's about like Jews and modernity. I think.
Yeah,
right?
That's exactly what it's like, and it's Marx, Freud, and Levi Strauss cases. Yep. But you think that's
I've heard
it?
You talk about it. Yeah, I mean, it's part of it, right? It's also that there are funding structures in the American university that are being pushed toward quantification for various ideological reasons, basically that they wanted to get rid of the social scientific critical tradition that really thrived in the 30s and 40s during the New Deal era.
So a lot of what happened was too Marxist influence.
Yeah, it is Marxist. You know, it is flat out Marxist. And so by the late 1940s, that becomes anathema. And so there's a new search for a new type of social science that is meant to be more quote unquote objective. And there's a search for abstraction. And it's also attractive to liberal foundation donors who wind up actually like the Ford Foundation, who wind up pushing a ton of money into the quote unquote behavioral sciences in the 50s and the 60s. And so it's amenable to a lot of these assimilating second generation Jews who aren't Marxist any longer, who were in the 30s, who are moving beyond it and who are trying to embrace a new form of economics. The problem, though, is that at this point, as I'm sure you would agree, it's become just a fetish, a literal fetish, where you're not actually saying much interesting about humanity or the economy and things along those lines. And in particular, and then we could get back to the book, in particular, what I think is happening right now is that people are really starting to question for the first time in almost a century these macro indicators like GDP and GNP And the very idea of an economy, the very idea of an economy only becomes an object of fascination in the 20s and the 30s, right? These are not natural human categories. I mean, this is where Foucault is actually important. Like the creation of the category is itself needs analysis, in itself needs analysis. And it's just happening now because I think you see there's such an obvious disconnect between economic indicator and economic experience. So like all this growth, the GDP is great and blah, 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 blah. But, you know, no one can buy a house under 55. So this is going to be an issue going forward.
There's a lot packed in there, Danny, quite a bit. Assimilation anxieties of Jews shaping the architecture of intellectual architecture of a major discipline for decades.
Yep, till down to today.
Just pause and think about that. Think about the sociocultural, historical implications of that.
I mean, and they're all Jews, Glenn, as you know, Samuelson, Arrow, Hirschman. I mean, Schelling isn't, but he was at the Society of Fellows, so he knew him.
knew him well. I knew Tom Schelling very well. but isn't that anti-Semitism, Danny?
Identifying cultural influence is not anti-Semitism to me, Glenn. Well, maybe it is under the new definition embraced by the American government.
Well, if you pointed out that the pedigree of mass murderers was of a particular character, or the genesis of street crime came out of a particular cultural niche, and you put an ethno-racial coloration on that, I think you'd be in difficult territory.
Well, it depends what you think about like small group evolution, which I think is basically bullshit. The idea that like human groups over the course of like 400 years are able to embrace some sort of cultural characteristics. I mean, and that's what essentially an anti-Semitic or anti-Black argument would have to rely on, that like in the last 500 years, something in the history of human evolution happened, which has never happened before, which I just think it's historical and it's contextual. And I think this is where history allows you to get into places that social science and especially the hard sciences don't really allow you to get into, and just identifying the historical situatedness of a particular group is not anti anything. It's just trying to understand. There are different Jewish responses to it as well. A lot of the socialists were Jews as well. They took a different form of universalism. I would say what unites it is this embrace of universalism in its particular forms, whether a socialistic humanitarian universalism or an abstract calculation-based universalism. What's united is this universalism, which emerges from Jewish ethnic particularity, particularly in Europe, and the desire to become fully part of the community. So it's embraces of different forms of universalism.
So that raises, I see, forgive me for interrupting you. I just wanted to observe that raises the question of what does the Israel Project mean if this quest for a universal...
Well, it's the other response. It's the embrace of ethno-nationalist particularity, right? In the Holocaust...
It's the opposite pole. It's the opposite pole.
It's the exact same thing. There's several ways to respond to the Holocaust. One is to embrace universal humanity and say, like, we're all equal, and if we embrace true equality, then we'll never get the Holocaust again. Another one to say is, this is what the world does to Jews, and the best you can do is embrace sort of the ethno-nationalist particularity that led to the Holocaust, right? I mean, Clarence Thomas... There's a reason that he started out as a Black Power person, right? There's a response. The problem is that white society isn't going to accept you, right, for Clarence Thomas. So either you could basically try to create a legal structure that ensures that you're never helped by white society because they're never really going to help you anyway. So you've got to become your own self-actualized, individualistic person. Or there's another response to try to transform the society in a more universal direction. It's almost the same problem confronted by both groups.
Well, I'm not sure I agree, because you could eschew the universal path out of not a reaction against the oppression of the dominant, but as a self affirming assertion of responsibility, of dignity, whatever. The Clarence Thomas caricature that you invoke, I think there's truth in it, to be sure.
It's Corey Robbins' argument. I mean,
yeah, I know Corey Robbins' argument. I've read that book. But I don't think it completely subsumes it. So certainly not if I compare myself to Clarence Thomas, and I think there's some similarities if I were to look in an introspective way. I would say and this also touches on some of what Soul was writing at the time of the enactment of the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the kind of codification of the Supreme Court's 54 decision in the Brown case and subsequent judicial rulings. Whether or not integration as a goal, I guess this is a kind of universalism. It's a small U universalism. Was the way to go. And the value of the Black institutions that had emerged in the context of segregation, you're affirming that not just because you don't think universalism would work, but because maybe you don't think universalism is that great a deal for you. You lose some of your identity. You lose some of your essence. And now I'm not affirming this point of view. I'm just describing it.
Yeah, I mean, and then you would have to just contextualize it. Then you would have to do the deep historical analysis and see how and why someone changes over time. But I do think that there's an element of minority groups responding to majoritarian society, and there are only so many ways one can respond to that. That's basically my take. And I think one sees that through the various Jewish responses to the Holocaust, from Israel to socialism, from Bernie Sanders to Netanyahu. These are different responses to the problem of Jews' position in basically Western modernity.
Now, you said something earlier about the economy that I thought was interesting. You say the very idea of an economy is a construction. It's an invention. It occurs in real historic time. You can see its evolution and you can analyze it. And I thought that that was very interesting. And isn't it true that the very idea of a Jew is a construction and emerges over a period of time and can be subjected to analysis? Can we analyze it?
Yeah, of course. I mean, and many people have. You could even see it in the Bible. I think it's you see the shift, if I'm remembering correctly, from Hebrew to Israelite. And then people have written about how in the Second Temple period, a great historian at Columbia, Seth Schwartz, you see the move from to proto-Judaism, which is basically these individualistic cultic centers once the temple was destroyed. Absolutely. You could historicize anything, including the category of Jew, the category of Black, the category of American, the category of international relations, of geopolitics, of the economy. And it basically, one does historicize them, and I think it changes over time how these things are perceived and how they develop. And the historicization, what I like about history is it allows you to see sort of choices that were made with the original conception of what something was. Like, what counts as being part of the economy is an important question, because what is left out might actually wind up shaping how we do things like welfare or redistribution or regulation or things along those lines. I think that's what history brings that basically no other discipline does. If you're a social scientific discipline, to some degree, you have to accept it as natural. Otherwise, you won't be able to do your work. You have to assume that if you're an economist, you have to assume that there's a thing called an economy. If you're a political scientist, an IR guy, you have to assume that there's a realm of life called geopolitics that has its own logics and laws. But in actuality, these are just categories by which human beings make sense out of a basically irreducibly complex reality. And so analyzing the origins of the category is, I think, quite interesting, personally.
What do you think about Larry Summers?
Not a fan. I think he's very much of his time. I mean,
friend
of the pod, Larry. We were both banned by Russia on the same list, I believe. We're both sanctioned.
That's
by
true.
Russia.
You're
so
you're,
we're brothers you're in arms.
Like this. I mean, you're tight.
First of all, if I recall correctly, he's Arrow's nephew, right? And also the child.
He's also Paul Samuelson's nephew, if I'm not mistaken. I think on both sides of his family, there are siblings who are great economists, Nobel laureate types.
Yes. So, I mean, for Larry Summers, I would say he's like extraordinarily a product of his neoliberal moment. And it's interesting, you could compare him, if one was writing a dual biography, you could compare, Glenn, I think I've told you this, I've always thought writing a dual biography of you and Adolf Reed would be interesting. I think a dual biography of Summers and Jeffrey Sachs would be interesting. Very similar Jewish economists of the same generation encountering the same thing in post-Soviet Russia, Soviet Union, and having very divergent responses. And then you would basically analyze them through their primary source documentation, the way things change over time, to see why they develop those. And
that's, I think, that's a brilliant project. You should do it, Danny. It'll make a historic book.
Yeah, it is a good idea. But I mean, I think Summers just bought in, right? When you've like been able to succeed so much in that particular space, he's not able to see outside of his ideology. But what I basically think is that neoliberalism was a genuine response to the stagnation of the mid-century Fordist economy. And that basically, to analyze neoliberalism historically, I've done it empirically through Hollywood, in particular as like a paradigmatic neoliberal industry. Initially, it does basically pump money into the economy. So when the 70s Ford economy is stagnating, the neoliberal deregulation is really successful in the short term. It really does pump money into the economy and it allows for growth. But I think over time, there's a basically diminishing returns to it. And so this is the crisis of capitalism, is that over time, the returns lessen. There's a falling rate of profit. And so what you're having now is that the capitalist class needs to basically maintain the same level of growth, the same rate of profit. And it, the only way it can really do that is to get rid of labor, which is effectively what AI is. That is the big gamble of the capitalist class, is that you're going to basically reduce labor costs. Unfortunately, that's not good for society. And so there needs to be a social response to it. However, the neoliberal deregulatory apparatus has basically gotten rid of all the ways we would have been able to meaningfully respond to this problem. So this is why we're in a pretty bad situation, I would say, right now. And Summers can't even think of that. You know, he's so ideologically in hock to traditional neoclassical economics, or what passes neoclassical economics when he was trained in the 70s, 80s, and beyond, that he can't even see that as a problem.
I don't see Sachs deviating that much from that. Sachs is keenly emphasizing the global commons problem of climate. He's an internationalist who wants to see the strengthened prerogatives of the community of nations through the United Nations and international law, whatnot. But if you ask him about the future of Southeast Asia, he's going to sound as neoliberal as Larry Summers is in terms of markets and free enterprise and the implications, dynamic implications of technological evolution and whatnot.
I think he was also limited by his time. I mean, I think like that the big thing with when you're talking about the international economy is that I think that there's a lot of negative externalities to global trade in terms of climate and in terms of basically what these local economies wind up focusing on to get to the international to basically participate in the international market. And that's ultimately a problem of global capitalism. And so, I mean, the real problem of the age is that there's no alternative to it. There's no even thinking beyond it. And I think that's, to say the least, going to be a major problem. I mean, I think capitalism is historically situated and it's reached the limits of its basically ability to contribute positively to the story of humanity. That's what I genuinely think.
They've been saying that for a while, man.
Yeah, I know.
And they've been saying that when life expectancy was 45 years.
And in terms of...
In terms of the quality of life and the level of the underlying engine of productivity to accommodate the subjective needs of the populations.
Well, this gets into countercultural.
They live longer, they're healthier, et cetera.
Well, this gets into a counterfactual, which is that dependent on capitalism? Right, which is very, very difficult to know whether that was dependent on capitalism or that was naturally going to emerge due to technological developments that emerged in the 20th century. That absolutely emerged from capitalist innovation in the 19th and early 20th century. And then you're going to go, but what about the socialist world? And I'm going to say, well, they super undeveloped societies that for various reasons embraced a form of revolutionary communism that caused a lot of terror in the short and medium terms, both in the Soviet Union and in the People's Republic of China. But I would ask, who's winning the 21st century? Is it the United States or the PRC? I think that's a pretty clear answer to that one, and it's not the United States. This is not to oversee
but
the horrors.
But to the extent that the PRC is winning, they're winning because they're emulating the very kinds of dynamic social relations that you associate with capitalism.
But then the question, I mean, this goes back to, I know you've read Marx, so this is just Marx 101. You have to pass through capitalism. I don't think the PRC is doing that, by the way. I think they are just a capitalist power. I do not think they are harnessing capitalism for the interests of the revolution. I think capitalism did win. I think that that is not even a question at this point. Like, capitalism conquered the world. Socialism and communism did not. It lost out in that grand historical struggle. And I think that this is why, as Marx predicted on the first page of the Communist Manifesto, we are going to enter an era of mutual ruin, that we're not going to actually harness these technologies in the interest of humanity. We're going to harness them to make profit. And that is eventually going to harm humanity. That's basically my analysis of the present situation.
Now, the nuclear standoff, Trump just ordered some submarines to relocate, and it became a big scandal because it's provocative, and we're in a conflict, a proxy war with Russia. And if we're going to blow ourselves up, this is the how it's going to start, you know, kind of thing like that. Is that capitalism's fault, too?
No. So I would say that there are two. This is why I always say you need your Engels with your Marx. Engels is the one who really writes about physical security and violence. And I think these are two parallel things, economy, and we call it security, but I would just say basically how violence is organized and distributed in a society. And I always say this, this is like, I think all political traditions do not have a good way of embedding these two things. That if you read like the great book on the Global Capitalism book by Leo Panitch and Sam Gindin, they kind of bracket the security issue on the first page. They're like, we're not going to talk about that, because if you look at our actual world, what do we have? We have a genuinely global capitalist system with an international bourgeoisie that's, you know, people in New York are more similar to people in Delhi and Dubai, whatever. How about, even though our cultural differences, the capitalists are relatively similar. But at the same time, we have a nation state based security apparatus, where the United States is basically the global hegemon, and that's not an international thing. That's not a multilateral force. That is a nation state-based security apparatus. So I think you need to figure out how these two things go together, and we haven't theoretically done that. If I were to write a big theory book, that's what it would be on. It would be bringing those two things together, Marx with Engels. That Engels is the one who writes about the army. Engels is the one who writes about the military. Engels is the one who writes about violence. And I think that is in parallel to capitalism, but it is not the same thing. It does not emerge from capitalism. It has its own human logic, its own sort of spring of logic. So that's what I would say to that.
You're an interesting fellow, Daniel. Very interesting.
Capitalism does push it in some direction. Like, the reason that the United States wants to be hegemonic in East Asia is primarily for economic reasons. That China does not threaten the U.S. security. What China does threaten is U.S. global capitalist domination. But I don't think it's ultimately, you can't reduce it to that. Like William Appleman Williams and Gabriel Coco and the revisionists of the Wisconsin School did, is what I would say.
Now, what do you make of what Jeff Sachs, you mentioned him, is saying about these kind of things? He's very bullish on China. He travels over there a lot. He is very negative on the Ukraine war. He basically says what John Mearsheimer says about NATO coming up to Putin's border.
Mearsheimer has a very naive view of international relations, in my opinion. I have an essay coming out about him in my book. It's very, very naive and very simplistic. And I think emerges from an incredibly naive understanding of human nature. Though I do agree with Mearsheimer politically, oftentimes.
You agree with him about Ukraine?
Well, I think he's monocausal. It's not just due to, I think NATO was one of three things that were major causes. You have the sort of the U.S. embracing the security buffer of Russia's near abroad, which wasn't going to be kind to Russia. You have Putin, the individual, who obviously has this theory of Russian greatness. And then you have Russia wanting to be basically a great power again. And those three combined with regards Ukraine. But he reduces it to NATO, which makes sense, I guess, in the Western context, because that, the only one we could have theoretically controlled was the NATO one. We couldn't control like Putin's mind, Putin's psychology. So I guess that makes sense. But I just think like Mersheimer's writings on international relations are too simplistic to be especially useful. The idea that offensive realism, that states naturally expand because that's the only way to guarantee security, is, I don't think, historically true. And I don't think true according to any sense of human nature. If anything, you could argue the opposite, that the story of humanity over the last 1,000 years has been about the embrace of larger and larger political communities, from the family to the town to the village to the blah, 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 going all the way up to the nation state. There's no reason it can't go to the region and eventually the world. So I think it's just not correct. I think realism is wrong in a lot of regards. But Sachs is right that I think it's wild that the United States is supporting Ukraine. And it was very predictable, as I predicted from day one, that this is where this war was going to wind up.
Which is with the Russians winning on the battlefield and Ukrainian casualties going through the ceiling.
Yeah, it's just of more interest to Russia, just like Taiwan is of more interest to China. I mean, these are facts of international relations. Sorry.
You're not worried about Putin expanding into the Balkans?
No, I have a brain. No. I mean, that's Anne Applebaum nonsense. It's nonsense, literally nonsense. It's like not even worth taking seriously. The fact that it is taken seriously shows the degradation of the discourse around foreign relations in this country. Obviously, Russia could barely conquer Ukraine. We're talking about getting 20% of Ukraine. Imagine saying that to the Soviet Union. Like, they're struggling for 20%. You're going to take Poland? What are you talking about? It's unserious, Glenn. And a lot of our discussion in this country about foreign relations is unserious. And that's what I find annoying.
Interesting. Now, Sachs and Mearsheimer are very outspoken about the Gaza conflict and more generally about the Israel-Palestinian conflict. Do you think they're right?
I do. I don't know specifically what they say, but I mean, this was very predictable from day one. I think I even predicted it on your podcast that we did with Tyler Harper and John about where this was going to go, because this is where Israeli government officials said it was going to go from day one. And I don't know why Americans are so shocked by what has happened, given that this is what the Israeli government has said that they wanted to construct, a greater Israel. Likud has been saying this for 50 years, and Jabotinsky has been saying it for well longer than that. So I mean, again, unserious. It is an unserious discussion. It was very predictable where this was going to go. The Democratic Party has blood on its hands, as obviously does the Republican Party. And one day, like that book said, everyone will have been against this, but these both political parties supported it and did it. And actually, Derek, I know you had a question for Glenn. This might be a good time to ask it.
Well, yes. I mean, we've kind of gotten away from the book, but you—I know you had—you ran into some problems at the Manhattan Institute because of your position on Gaza, and you mentioned in your newsletter that this would have made an interesting addition to the story that you tell in the book. And so, I was going to ask this after we sort of had established the story of the book. But, you know, not to talk specifically about that incident, but your sense of or what that experience said to you about the themes that you touch on in the book and you know, how that would have changed or elucidated parts of it, I guess, parts of the message.
What my Manhattan Institute experience says about the themes of the book. So what are the themes of the book a community of discourse can be influenced by the following phenomenon. There are sensitive issues on which there's a consensus way of expressing yourself, which is, let's say, not 100% in keeping with the reality of the situation, but there are taboos and closures and no-go spaces. People are varied in their assessment of whatever the conflict or controversy might be of the day. And some of them are, while basically reliable and loyal to and committed to the group, are given to venture into these forbidden territory. So in particular, in the issue of responding to the Israel-Palestinian conflict, I'm in New York City. I'm with the Manhattan Institute. They have a sort of understood consensus reading of these matters. And I'm a podcaster whose program is partly supported by the Institute, who talks about these matters in public. And I violate the consensus code. Now, in the essay, which became this small book that's just been republished, I try to analyze the logic of why cancellation might follow in the train of someone who speaks cutting across the grain. And it's basically, it's a signaling argument where I say, look, there are people with good and bad values. There are people who really are anti-Semites, who really are racist, who really are transphobic. They don't experience the reaction, the negative reaction to them expressing their view with the same, the shunning, the disapproval, the being called an anti-Semite, a racist, a transphobe. They don't experience, the ones who really are, the negativity of that to anything like the extent of someone who is not a practicer of the dark art, but who simply has a different reading of what might be going on. Someone like myself, who is not anti-Semitic, but who has a reaction, a revulsion, a horror at the a slaughter that's being prosecuted against the these people in Gaza. Or someone who says, looking at the long history of the conflict, I mean, you know, this is a... If the Palestinians were to say a historic crime of monumental proportions is being perpetrated against us by Zionism, they would have an argument. Somebody who thinks that. That person in the context of the Manhattan Institute is not going to survive for very long. Everybody's going to say he's not on our side. He can't be trusted. What else does he think? What are his real motives? They're going to be suspicious of him or her. That was me at the Manhattan Institute with respect to this issue about Palestine and Israel. And it's been a very liberating experience for me.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
That's what I wanted to ask. How has this reformed? Because you're, I think I've said this to you before. What I find fascinating about you is that you're generally always true to yourself. I think even if you go back and you look at like you were making these motivations to switch from conservative to liberal in the 90s for various communal reasons and individualistic reasons, but it's genuinely felt. So I was curious, has this reshaped your relationship to modern conservatism? Because I think in the last decade or so, you've been, really been on the anti-woke train, particularly when it came to Black relations and sort of Black positions in the United States and BLM. But like, to me, one of the reasons that we don't focus so much on that, on like quote unquote woke stuff on the show, it seems like not that important fundamentally. It seems like occurring at the level of culture war, and I don't think culture war is that important. So in the breach, the Manhattan Institute will be anti-woke, but they'll also support Israel. And which one of those is more important? And so I'm curious, has this reshaped or led you to rethink your relationship to, you know, Glenn Lowry's late in life return to quote-unquote conservatism, even though I don't really think that's correct. But you know the question that I'm asking.
I think it's a process. I'm 77, as I announced at the beginning of this show. So I don't know how much time I got left. We'll see. I'm trying to take care of myself. I'm going to go get a good bike ride in after this conversation is over. And I try to do that every day for an hour or so. So I should knock on wood over here. I remarried. My late wife, Linda Lowry, was my classmate practically. She was a couple of years behind me at MIT back in the 70s when we both did economics PhDs. And we have two sons, Glenn and Nehemiah. But she passed away in 2011, victim of breast cancer. And I remarried in 2017 to a woman, a working class woman from Houston, African American, cybersecurity expert and a very astute lady, but an autodidact and, you know, not a whole lot of Ivy League polish and all of that kind of stuff. Anyway, we are on an adventure here, and I have to acknowledge that my wife LaJuan's sensibility, which was a Bernie bro until Bernie got cooped it. That's how she would put it. He got co-opted, cooped it is the way she would put it, by the Democratic Party. And now she's an anti-Bernie bro because he sold us out. He didn't, you know, whatever. And many other things besides. I could go on for a long time talking about her. So anyway, but the keen concern about the moral dimensions of the Zionist project and its imprint of colonial imposition and so forth. I use these words advisedly that leads to genocide. I use these words cautiously because these words do not come naturally to me. And these words are like throwing down a gauntlet. You know, I mean, if Ta-Nehisi Coates goes over there to the West Bank on a excursion and he comes back and he says apartheid and everybody goes ballistic. And I'm saying, I'm reading Coates, and Coates is a very good writer. And I'm saying, it is kind of apartheid-like, isn't it? I mean, it is kind of, it does have certain features that you could see why the guy, now, does he give a very erudite and in-depth analysis of all of the historical and the whatever? No, but he goes and he has a reaction. Anyway, that's the kind of thing that she would pick up on in a heartbeat, and it would be reverberated in conversation back and forth between us. I'm rethinking everything, Daniel. I really am, and I don't know how it's going to come out, but I'm a free agent.
It's going to come out in Marxism and the embrace of the true science of historical materialism. But doesn't that, this is the problem with American.
We'll see how long that lasts. When Danny gets sanctioned by the Chinese government.
It's funny. I'm writing a piece right now on sort of the fact that American political categories of liberal and conservative really don't make sense in this country, and they never did. They're really only an artifact of the 1940s. Before that, Americans did not use that spectrum to define their politics. And the reason that spectrum was embraced was because essentially New Deal liberals started using it in the 30s and the 40s to define themselves as the center. And then there was something on the right, which was fascism, and something on the left, which was communism. And then in the 50s, Buckley, in his sort of anti-New Deal project, embraced this sort of notion of conservatism in relation to the New Deal. But basically 100 years after the New Deal exists, it doesn't really make sense anymore as a category. So this is why I think, like, and Glenn, I think you're a perfect example of that. You haven't actually really been moving back between liberal and conservative, because you've been moving back between various American, more American positions than you have been left-right in the European sense, which is where that spectrum actually emerges from. But to me, it's a profound failing of the conservative movement that they really have no answer to Israel. That their response is basically it's not happening, or it's a lie, or they're manipulating you. And to me, that's an intellectual weakness, and it sort of goes to the heart of the project, that Barry Weiss is the best that they could have. And I'm just curious if you, which is just like, it's just no shade on Barry. She's a business genius. But it's just like, it's not serious. And right now, both the liberal intellectuals and the conservative intellectuals, the mainstream ones, don't seem serious. They're not Richard Hofstadter. They're not Arthur Schlesinger. They're not even they're certainly not Hayek, you know, they're not von Mises. And so there's a real sort of lack at the center of mainstream intellectual culture right now. And I'm curious what you think it says maybe about that or the conservative movement. You can really take that in any direction.
Well, again, I think you're an interesting fellow. These observations are stimulating. I was going to locate the response to Israel on the conservative end of the spectrum in America First and insistence on the independence of U.S. from Israeli foreign policy and the concern about Tucker Carlson gives voice to this, the undue influence of this little country on the course of the exercise of American prerogative. That, and again, I'm not advocating anything here. I'm just, if I were to describe what would a conservative reaction.
But that's a pre-1945 conservatism. That is not conservatism as it's been for the last 75 years. That is Albert Nock, you know, Taft, who lost.
So it's an anachronism, is it?
Well, it's not an it's returning to basically what I would say is a more natural American position. For the first 175 years of this country, that was the position. It was changed by basically New Deal, Coombe, Cold War liberals in the 1940s. But so, that's not the conservative movement.
So what's
movement
going
as
on now? What, is it civilization versus barbarism? Is it Israel is the West and we stand with our civilization?
In terms of like mainstream conservative, what's going on amongst whom?
Failure of conservatism, its position on Israel. I assume that implies that you think there's something inadequate about its position on Israel.
I think that's right. I mean, I essentially think, well, first of all, I think there's just actually a lot of institutional inertia. And that it's been the position of the United States for 40 years to basically have very little daylight between itself and Israel for a variety of reasons, both domestic, political, and geostrategic. But I think that, yes, it's basically that they're not willing to see what's actually happening in Israel right now to any real degree. And that's an intellectual failure of the movement to confront what's actually happening. The mainstream conservative movement, not Tucker Carlson or Marjorie Taylor Greene, who had their resolution voted against, what was it, like by 95% of people, like the Manhattan Institute, or even see where you are now at the Hoover. What are Hoover people saying? I would imagine it's kind of support Israel, would be my guess. Neil Ferguson is not support Israel. You know, he is support Israel. And so that's an intellectual failure, I think.
I dare not reply to that because of the themes of self-censorship that I analyze in my book.
I mean, fair enough. But I actually cut you. What did you want to ask me about Gaza and Israel before Derek asked his question, if you remember?
I'm reading this book here by Avi Shlaim.
Oh, Avi Shlaim.
Avi Shlaim, is that how you pronounce it?
Yeah, a Be'ivrit in Hebrew. I think that's how you'd pronounce it. Shlaim, yeah.
Genocide in Gaza. It's a collection of his pieces over the last 5 years about what's going on. I don't know what to ask you. I mean, this is Jewish nationalism, isn't it? This is...
Certainly, I would think, yeah.
I mean, I read Peter Beinart, being Jewish after the destruction of Gaza. He's very observant and he's very concerned about the soul of his people. And I heard Yuval Harari give a podcast interview recently where he told this wonderful story about going back to the fall of the Roman. Conquest of Judea, what is it, 70 AD, something like that?
Yeah, 71. I used to know it by heart, 70 or 71.
So there was a rabbi. The rabbi went to the Romans and said, preserve a little bit of cultural space for me so that we can reflect on moral questions as Jews. And the Roman centurion prelate said, yes, okay, fine. And he went off and he just, this rabbi started a school of reflection of Talmudic, et cetera. And it was rich and wonderful and whatnot. And Harari says, and we get to this point and we act like the Romans. We don't act like a morally elevated people who have used the last 2,000 years to contemplate the meanings of humanity and of existence. Instead, we act like the Romans. We didn't have to study for 2,000 years. We could have just asked them, how do you wield power ruthlessly? How do you dominate weaker peoples? How do you take relish in the river of blood that's at your feet? And I thought how he's being sarcastic in a way. You know, he's being ironical, but he's challenging the Jewish people to come to terms with the meaning of this nationalist, these are going to be my words now, but not just a cul-de-sac. This is the road to hell, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and what Netanyahu and El Cetera say, like, this is just the reality of international politics or domestic politics. You see what happens when the Jews are a diasporic people. They get annihilated by the Nazis. And so the only way for the Jewish people to become fully part of Western modernity is to act like a Western state. And I think that is the underlying assumption here, that this is the way, in some sense, that the Jews become fully amalgamated into North Atlantic modernity through a colonial settler project, which I don't know why that's complicated. Literally, the Yishuv means colonial settlement. Israel was conceived of as such, as a colonial project from its inception, because it obviously was. And they would say, yeah, like, that's nice. Like, you could have your Jewish universalism, whatever. But in reality, that winds up in Auschwitz. And so we know the real situation, which is that you've got to basically be strong, have nuclear weapons, and do what is necessary to become part of the real community of nations. And I imagine people within Israel would say, and I believe I've heard this before, like, what did the United States do to its native peoples? They dare question us about what we're doing. What do you think happened over the course of the 19th and 18th and 19th centuries? And so I think that's what's happening here. And they would basically deride Jewish universalism as naive, especially in the shadow of Auschwitz.
Are they right?
No, I do not think they are right. For a couple of reasons. I think that the particularities that led to the Holocaust are unique and unrepeatable. Also, the tragic reality is that Europe is basically free of Jews, and European culture, the Jew is really an other in a way that we are not in other societies. I think the position of Jews in the United States is very, very different. And I think Israel is basically a fact, which is why I find the question of, does it have a right to, but what does that even mean? You know, it does exist and it's not going anywhere. The question is how it's going to treat its minoritarian population. And Israel has obviously provided an answer. But no, I don't think that an ethno-national fortress was the necessary response to the Holocaust. I don't think Jewish annihilation relies, the protecting against Jewish annihilation relies on an ethno-nationalist state, particularly given the reality of the United States in this world. Though, again, in 1950, I can understand why people would think that, right? I'm not judging the mid-20th century Jews who had a particular relationship to Israel.
Is this a modern project?
In terms of what?
Well, I mean, it seems like a throwback to something. I mean, the European Union. So this is
I see what you're saying.
Creation of a kind of nation state model that's modern in a way that this seems like it's medieval almost in its connotations.
Well, I would say early modern more than medieval, but I think basically because the Jews were a genuinely minoritarian, quote unquote, nation, that's how they were conceived, in a majoritarian society. So it's not like if the Kurds were given a nation state, for example, or what have you, I think you might see similar processes. So I don't think it's necessarily indicative to like any like trans-historical Jewishness, but rather had to do with the historical position of the Jews in European North Atlantic society, essentially. And it's coming late. It's coming several hundred years after all the other countries did, you know, the British conquered Ireland, the Americans expanded through Manifest Destiny, et cetera, et cetera. It's coming late. But it's actually a profoundly modern project, maybe not a post-postmodern project, which is the historical time we're living through. It seems atavistic, I think, is what you're getting at, because we were not alive for this project here.
The United States is obviously the gorilla in the room here in terms of the military and the, you know, global footprint. And the Jewish influence on American life is obviously punching above weight and, you know, I don't know, 3% of the population, 2% of the population, but a lot more than 2% of the weight. Is there something peculiar in the American Jewish experience that, you know, Mearsheimer has this book out there with Wall about the Israel lobby, but it strikes me that the kind of thing that they're talking about, there's only, you know, a small part of it. I saw John Stewart interview Peter Beinart, mentioned Beinart's book already, and Stewart, in his comedic way, was emphasizing the fact that he's Jewish and that, you know, he's a bad Jew because he's very troubled about what's going on in Gaza. And he's sympathetic to Beinart's, I think, very eloquent kind of protestation that this is not the right road for the Jewish people to be on and so on. But it was a conversation amongst Jews. And I was kind of like, I thought that was really very interesting. But anyway, I ramble. I'm trying to ask, is there something in the American Jewish experience that is especially relevant to this project of that you rooted in the European context of this creation of the State of Israel?
Well, I think that's a historical question, and I think it relates to the relationship that Israel developed with organized American Jewish institutions in the 1960s, particularly after the Holocaust post-Eichmann trial started to become talked about much more among American Jews than it was in the late 1940s and 1950s. And so there was an institutional relationship developed between Israel, both government and non-governmental organizations and groups like AIPAC, but also individual synagogues where there was sort of population exchanges and whatnot, where, you know, you would be sent over in a teen tour, or there would be an IDF soldier that would come to your synagogue and speak. So I think that's basically there was a very tight historical relationship developed, again, in the shadow of Auschwitz. And I think that's really crucial. I think, again, Stewart, born in the 1960s, is the first post-Holocaust generation of Jews. And obviously there's going to be historical traumas there and a particular understanding of what it means to be a Jew in the world. And I think what you're seeing now is a shift in generations as the Holocaust recedes further into memory, as Israel very much does not seem like a weak nation state, but actually seems like almost the regional hegemon. Naturally, American Jews are going to view its actions different because there's not a genuine fear of Jewish eradication like there was in the 1960s. So I think it's a process of historical time changing, basically. I think it's a generational shift that's actually quite predictable. The lived experience of the Holocaust is receded, and therefore the relationship to Israel will change. And in fact, Glenn, just to bring it back to a broader problem, I think one of the reasons that we've seen things like increasing polarization actually is that the experience of World War II has faded. And that the experience of mass coming together that really defined the American experience between 1941 and 1945, and the fact that it was the last war that was really a mass war, much more so than Vietnam. And as you know, the draft has ended since the early 1970s. Once that experience of communality is no longer in lived experience, I think you see atomization, polarization, and turning away. So I think this is something that's happening broadly, is that we're moving away from the experiences of the mid-20th century and how they defined life. And so we're seeing political shifts in a lot of different arenas. Israel, yes, but also general social American sociality and what it means to be an American and how Americans relate to one another. Plus, sorry, final thing, the material fact is that we have an incredibly strange political structure, is that places with 40 million people like California have the same Senate vote as places like Wyoming. So there's always going to be a lag in American politics, because if you actually look where most Americans live, they live in whatever, it's 7-8 sort of mega clusters, you know, Boswash and California and Portland into Seattle and like the Sun Belt around Phoenix. And those people who live in those urban areas actually share a lot of similar opinions, but our structure doesn't allow those opinions to be meaningfully expressed. So there's a sort of perverse element to American politics that I think is being reflected now to a large degree.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot there. So Glenn, we've had you on for a while. Is there anything else you'd want to say about self-censorship? Everyone, we got a little bit away from the book, but I think as you can tell, Glenn is a very interesting and compelling thinker. And so you should definitely check out the book when you have a chance. Again, self-censorship. Actually, maybe we could talk a little bit about the afterword and then we could go. So what were you trying to get at in the afterword? Why do you think this book is relevant to today? And what do you think, what is your take on wokeness now in 2025 and Trump's second administration? Woke is dead. No one cares any longer. The United States is being its good old imperialistic capitalist self. Trump fired the head of the Bureau of Labor Statistics for giving bad economic numbers. I mean, I think you and I were both like very damn you Democrats. You didn't do what was necessary. But Trump too is pretty bad, pretty anti-intellectual, pretty unserious, sort of the dying boomer behemoth, the gorilla stampeding through American society. So maybe you could talk a little bit about the afterword and what do you make of this first 6 months of Trump?
Okay, well, that characterization of Trump was epic. I it makes me smile. So the afterword is a telling of a personal story of my own censoring of myself. I'm invited by admirers to give an address on Black. What happened to the partnership between Blacks and Jews, a kind of theme at a synagogue in Palm Beach, Florida. And I go and I give a talk. I don't want to talk about my talk because this was in early 2024 and the conflict in Gaza had already heated up very much. And I was distressed by the early indications of what we have seen come to pass there. And would, left to my own devices, have been inclined to speak about it. I'm talking to a Jewish audience, and I'm being invited to the Levy Forum. Paul Levy is the benefactor, Palm Beach Synagogue. But I was afraid to talk about Gaza, because I was afraid to offend the congregation. And I knew that it would open up a kind of conversation like the one that we've been having here, in which I would then be led to speculate and reflect further on the project, which is the creation of the State of Israel. And I knew that my views were, you know, if not set in stone, then, but definitely inclined against, to be critical of aspects of the Zionist project that these people would hold dear, that they would think was. So I avoided the subject of Gaza altogether, and I feel like I betrayed something, the truth, somehow, if only the truth to my own sensibilities, when I did so. And I realized I did so because I made a calculation, because I anticipated how I would be seen by the audience if I were to express myself, and the consequences that might have, both material and social, for my subsequent quality of life. And so there was something craven, there was something surrendering to something. There's something about the utilitarian calculation, about the way that my bottom line was not humane at some level. It was not my bottom line of what was driving my behavior was deficient in some way morally. So I had failed, you know. Anyway, I try to talk about this experience in the afterword and try to raise the question. You know, we know what we have to lose if we speak out. What do we have to lose if we don't speak out? And one of the things that we have to lose is we don't speak out is that we contribute to a social failure, because a lot of us are not speaking out. And one of the reasons we're not speaking out is because we don't know that there are others who share our views sufficient that it would be not a lone wolf to speak out. And why don't we know? Because they're not speaking out, and we're kind of in this bad equilibrium. But there's also the question of self-respect. There's what kind of person are you who doesn't speak out? You're comfortable. You're safe. I'm an American of middle, upper middle class status. My life is good. I don't worry about my personal security or whatever. I have a megaphone. People are listening to me. I have a responsibility. And I'm not speaking because it's inconvenient. That's despicable at some level. So I say, I don't know that I will remember the sentence exactly. I don't know whether I could afford or not to have spoken my mind at that Palm Beach synagogue. But I do know that if I valued my own self-respect, I couldn't afford not to pay that cost, whatever the cost was going to be. That's the sentiment that I want to end on in a small book about the theme of self-censorship. There are all kinds of calculations to make here, what the repercussions will be. But one of them that shouldn't be lost track of is your own self-respect. What kind of person are you?
I agree. And I also think the Chomskyan sort of injunction to speak the truth goes along, particularly as the social role of the intellectual, being a tenured professor, the last good job in America, as I think Stanley Fish referred to it once, is really important. But before we go, I do want to get your take on Trump. What do you think? Because I knew you were excited a little bit at the beginning that you thought this augured a shift. Doesn't it all just seem like bullshit? Fake bullshit. Yeah, he's not going to do anything.
I'm trying to hold on to hope. I'm trying to, and things have not gone totally awry yet. But the bombast, the thuggery, the damage to institutions, the cavalier way in which enormous powers are being wielded, the there's no there there. I mean, is Peter Sellers really president of the United States?
Yes. There's nothing there. It's just anger. It's just anger, boomer.
I mentioned the deployment of these submarines. I was listening to some guys online, Judge Napolitano, Scott Ritter. I don't know if you know who they are. But, man, this is fucking nuclear war that we're talking about here. A tweet. Medvedev tweets a nasty tweet that Trump doesn't like, and he moves the American nuclear arsenal closer to Vladivostok or whatever. And I thought, this can't be happening. This can't be real. I mean, there's a lot of, you could go down the list. You mentioned the firing of the... This is very costly because it deals with the yes. credibility, and it's not undoable. It's not like you can, once you've done this, these are sacred lines that are being crossed.
Well, I think the thing is they've already been destroyed. This is more a symptom of the fact that the legitimacy of these institutions don't really exist.
Okay, that's a deeper analysis, and you're probably right about that. The tariffs made my hair stand on end. I mean, I'm not a trade economist, but I am an economist. I spent 4 years at MIT studying economics at the PhD level, and I know the guys like the Jeff Sachses of the world and the Paul Krugmans of the world. These are classmates and friends and affiliate. I mean, and they're not all crazy. Even Larry Summers, they're not all crazy. They have a point when they say that this kind of use of this enormous economic power in this cavalier, harebrained way is dangerous to the economy. I think it is dangerous. Fortunately, things haven't fallen apart yet, but it is unnerving in the extreme. Now, I thought he was going to end the Ukraine
with the
war.
Tariffs, there's a lag, right? I mean, it's going to take a few months for things to really hit.
We will see, and I am keeping my fingers crossed, but, I thought he was going to end the Ukraine war. He hasn't. I thought he was going to actually stand up to the Israel lobby. He hasn't. So I'm disappointed.
Yeah, it's all bullshit. There's just going to be there needs to be some sort of systemic change, and no one who's however old he is going to do it, just like Biden wasn't going to. Well, Glenn, we've had you here long enough.
The nuclear submarines thing is interesting to me because it's like a throwback to when he would get in feuds with like the editor of Vanity Fair. Like Dmitry Medvedev is the coat check guy in the Kremlin situation. Like he's powerless. And we're moving nuclear submarines because we got mad that he tweeted something. It's just an interesting, I think, callback to his days as a messy gossip
of hating Graydon Carter.
Exactly.
It's almost like the president shouldn't have this power, isn't it? It's almost like there's fundamental problems with the institution of the executive in this country because they're kind of like an elected monarch. I'm writing about that now. But Glenn, we've had you long enough. Everyone buy Self-Censorship. Link in the show notes. And we'd love to have you back, honestly, whenever you'd like.
Thanks a lot, Danny. It was fun.
Lowe's knows to bring your vision to life, it's important to find the right color. That's why Mylowe's Rewards members get a free Valspar paint or exterior stain sample to test your look to confidently refresh your space. Offer valid in-store only 87 to 820. Limit one per customer while supplies last. Discount taken in time of purchase. See associate for details. Rewards program subject to terms and conditions. Details at lowes.com/terms. Subject to change.